If we think that Christ-centered truths are important for the world today, we have got to be in those spaces bringing that forward, you know, in an appropriate, compassionate, loving, humble sort of way. But we need to be there, and we're not there the way that we should be.
Welcome to Christ in Culture, the podcast of the L. Russ Bush Center for Faith and Culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Here we'll explore how the Christian faith intersects all avenues of today's culture through conversations with leading thinkers. Welcome to The Conversation.
Hello, everyone. I'm Benjamin Quinn, and welcome to this week's episode of Christ in Culture. Today, we'll talk with Dr. Justin Barrett about how to be a Christian in science. And after that, we'll have another edition of our segment, On My Bookshelf. But before that, it's time for our segment we call Headlines, in which we look at some aspect of the headlines, such as news, sports, pop culture, business, etc., from a Christian perspective. We do all kinds of different things throughout our podcast episodes, but today we return to the most important conversation, or at least a most important conversation, sports. Very grateful to have joining us this afternoon is my dear friend, Pastor Cody Evans. Cody is, in fact, pastor of Covenant Hope Church here in Youngsville, North Carolina, and also serves as assistant director for our prison program. Assistant or associate?
Associate.
Associate director is what I said, of our prison program here at Southeastern Seminary. We'll have to have you back to talk a little bit more about what that prison program is like, really connected with our undergrad, the college at Southeastern. He's married to his sweet wife, Ashley. They have two boys and then one boy. They've just learned another boy on the way.
Right.
Cody is a, we'll say, a former athlete, although athletes have a hard time saying former. A fantastic basketball player, also played baseball and football along with his brother, Casey, who's a dear friend as well. Cody, thank you for being on the call with us.
Yeah, glad to be here and thankful for you guys and the work you do.
So to clarify, when I say a most important conversation relative to sports, what we're not suggesting is that sports are the most important thing in the world. In fact, part of our even our discussion and kind of theoretical thought relative to sports is that it actually malforms us in certain ways if we're not careful. But at the same time, sports being such a dominating part of our kind of cultural imagination, it's rare. It doesn't matter if you're talking to someone who ever played sports or not. You can go to virtually any part of our country, and in many cases, any part of the world, walk into a coffee shop, walk into a pub, walk into a restaurant, walk into a bookstore and say, hey, how are the Eagles doing? Or, hey, how'd the Cardinals do last night? Or, hey, what about the Lightning? And most likely somebody within earshot of your conversation are going to be able to answer that. Whether it's college sports, professional sports, whatever the case is, it brings communities together, but sometimes it malforms, which is part of why we think it's important for our own cultural evaluation to have these discussions. So for today, we're going to hit two quick sort of sports headlines. One of them is Jason Kelce's retirement. Think about what he said. How do we consider that from a Christian perspective? And then also we'll talk about this little-known thing called March Madness that's emerging over the next week or so. So let me kick that to you first, Cody. Talk to us about March Madness. What is this about? Why do we care as Christians?
So over the next couple of weeks, we're going to have conference tournaments. They're already started for women's and men's. Even in the big conferences are having their conference tournaments this week. And then after that, we're going to have March Madness, and it captivates us as an audience, I think, because we want to see ourselves as a part of bigger, being in something bigger than ourselves. Whether it's the brackets, right, that we fill out, and we're trying to – our kids are picking the blues and the reds and the oranges, or the Falcon mascot over the Camel mascot or whatever it is. Like, they get to actually be a part of something that the whole country's doing. And we actually get to see ourselves in the story of seeing the small teams, and we can all think of those teams that we've watched over the years that have gotten to the Final Four, and we're just hoping for them to actually win the national championship. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, it helps us think about, at the end of the day, the biggest Cinderella story, and to be cliche, is that Christ defeated death mm-hmm. on a cross, right? Mm-hmm. That he actually defeated death by dying. And our story is found in his story, but ultimately sports help us see and help us bring us together and help us see the greater story and a better story of actually death being defeated.
That's fascinating. It's, you know, one thing we probably haven't attended to very closely up to this point with sports is the storified dimension of that. In fact, Nathaniel, you and I were talking more previously about NASCAR. So NASCAR is enjoying some measure of revival in its ratings. Personally, I don't understand that. I just fall asleep every time I watch NASCAR.
One day you will.
Okay, maybe one day I will. And Cody is from Statesville, so he's particularly invested here. But tell us why story matters for even things like NASCAR. I'm not convinced it's a sport, by the way, but we'll talk about that later.
Well, it is a sport, but we will talk about that later. So NASCAR is having a revival in ratings, as you said. Ratings are up. Huge percentage numbers compared to last year. The one difference between this year and last year, there have been a couple really compelling finishes, but the biggest thing is there was a Netflix documentary that aired in the offseason. And for a lot of people who enjoy sports documentaries, they've watched this without knowing anything about NASCAR and now are invested in these drivers and the storylines. And so now we're tuning in, I would assume, to watch the sport because they're invested in the story. And so I think it just reminds us that we think we watch sports for the pure competition. Some of us do, but we're narrative creatures.
Yeah.
That we are, we enjoy connecting with stories. And so, like, you know, I like the Georgia Bulldogs as well. And so I enjoy following the storylines and being invested in what's going on and the trajectory and stuff. And so people are bought into these stories. They bought into the narratives and now are watching as a result.
You know, a really good illustration recently of that is the Last Dance documentary that came out. I think they released it a little bit early during COVID because we were all stuck at home anyway.
And I took that personally. There you go.
But this was this was the story of basically the Jordan era Chicago Bulls, right? They won six world championships during that time. Jordan is a part of all six. In fact, if he had not gone to baseball for a time, or if he had not retired when he did, there's a really good chance they would have won seven or eight total championships.
The greatest basketball player of all time,
right? Absolutely. Yeah. There's no question. We don't even have to pray about that. Yeah. He is absolutely, even despite what our friend Merrick Nunn thinks about that. But nevertheless, we'll come back to the story of the Bulls, the Michael Jordan era Bulls, is a fascinating one. And I realize you can tell these stories in different ways, but the kind of attention that documentary got. My wife and I think she and I both could watch that every day. We could just watch another episode because, first of all, you lived it, and that's part of it, is that you find yourself wound up in these stories and sort of those times past. But also there's something deeply inspiring about these, or at least hope-filled, I think, even when it's a downturn in your team's era. So, you know, I'm an Alabama fan. We've lost our great coach. We'll see what happens. But there's always that glimmer of hope, which, Cody, to your point, also reminds us at some level of the gospel. Jason Kelce retires, I think probably without too much argument, one of the greatest offensive centers in the National Football League history. I'm not sure he's the greatest, but he's definitely going to be up there with Jeff Saturday and others. Retired last week, and his retirement speech was fantastic. It was about 45 minutes long. He read it off his phone, as best I could tell, with cut-off T-shirt, which was amazing. And there's a lot of things that we could say.
Lyman-esque, right?
Say again?
Lyman-esque with his cut-off.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I didn't know some of his story, Nathaniel. Speaking of stories, I didn't realize that he was a walk-on in college, and then that he was actually, I think he was a linebacker forever, and then one of his coaches said, you would be a fantastic center. And eventually he starts trying that position, and his athleticism mixed with his strength and really being just the right size, he developed into one of the best centers ever. But let me just fixate on one part of his speech, and I would encourage you to watch the whole thing. Now, let me be really clear. I have no reason to believe he's a Christian. I'm not saying that it's the greatest sort of Christian retirement speech or anything like that. But one comment that he made along the way near the end, if I recall, is he talks about the impact of his father. And I've heard them talk about this before, as kind of his father being involved when he got the call. I think it was the sixth round of the NFL draft. He got the call that he was going to be drafted by the Eagles. And then several years later, his brother gets the call. He talked about his dad just running in, weeping. But the impact of his dad on his entire life, from Little League to high school to college to NFL, you know, he didn't go into great detail. It was simply just that plug of, you have no idea how important a father's role is in a kid's life. And, man, I wish he had hovered over that for another 10 minutes because that's so critical. Sports give us an opportunity. And I'll just speak as a dad of aspiring athletes. But some of the best father-son conversations come when you leave that competition, whether you won or lost. And last night was one of those. My son had a great game in the field. He struggled at the plate. And we had to work through that. Those are some of the best life father-son conversations. And Jason Kelce's retirement speech gave us just a little bit of a glimmer into that in his own life.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Benjamin, that what we're seeing across our country and culture right now is that We're coming to grips with the reality that, we need faithful dads, that dads need to be involved. They need to be in the lives of their kids and participating. And that helps our families be healthy when our when dads are involved and they're working in the lives of their kids and alongside of them and having these conversations. It helps us really kind of steward the next generation. And we have a great responsibility as dads to help our kids.
I would just put a plug out to any dads and moms listening. So Cody and I have both been involved in coaching rec league and those kind of things. And, you know, sometimes, Cody, you and I have talked about this, sometimes you can be frustrated when your kid gets on a team with a coach that may just not know a whole lot about the sport. And I understand that frustration. But at the same time, I'm always so encouraged and have said this to multiple coaches like that. Man, I'm just so thankful to see a dad involved in his son's life, or maybe daughter's life in that case, but also willing to spend, to invest time into these other kids' lives. And of course, it's ideal if you have somebody that knows something about the game or really can take your kid to the next level. But just seeing moms and dads involved in their kids' lives is such a gift. It's good for communities. It's good for kids. And especially when done in a carefully Christian way, a thoughtfully Christian way, I think it honors the Lord and His kingdom.
Well, I would also encourage dads and moms, if they're thinking about coaching, you just have to know 2% more than those kids. That's all you have to know. And you can be a fine coach to love them and help them love the sport that they're playing and live out the gospel in front of them. It's a great opportunity. If you're a parent, go try it.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground in this headline segment, from March Madness to NASCAR to fatherhood. We're about to jump into our Christ and Culture conversation with Dr. Justin Barrett. Before we do, just a reminder, go to your preferred podcast platform, subscribe, give us a rating, give us a brief review. It goes a long, long way to helping us spread the word about the Christ and Culture podcast. Now, time for our Christ and Culture conversation.
Southeastern wants you to be equipped to serve the church and fulfill the Great Commission. That's why we offer our Master of Divinity degree, which provides rigorous biblical and theological training for your current and future ministries. Our Master of Divinity offers broad ministerial training while facilitating a deep engagement with the Bible, all within a textual community that focuses on spiritual formation and ministry preparation. Come be shaped as a Great Commission Christian and experience theological education to the fullest. Visit sebts.edu/MDiv to learn more.
Today, we're delighted to have back on the podcast Dr. Justin Barrett. Dr. Barrett is president of Blueprint 1543, an honorary professor of theology and the sciences at St. Andrews University School of Divinity. He's also a faithful Christian, and he recently joined us at our Exploring Personhood conference a couple of years ago. We're glad to have him back here with us today on the podcast. Dr. Barrett, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Barrett, tell us a little bit about yourself, your work, and what you do.
Sure. I am now a former university professor. I've taught at Calvin University, University of Michigan, Fuller's Theological Seminary in the School of Psychology, and Oxford University in the School of Anthropology. And now I'm the president of Blueprint 1543, and we're a little organization that's trying to catalyze a sort of a faithful, responsible engagement between the Christian faith and the sciences, especially the human sciences. And we do this through coaching, convening, field development, all kinds of other fun stuff that we get to do. So that's what kind of keeps me busy.
You're a scientist. You're also a believer, a Christian. Tell me about your faith journey a little bit and how that's intersected with your science work, the frustrations or tensions or the things that have gone well. Just talk a little bit about your faith journey as well.
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in a Christian family, mostly in my family background. My my parents were raised in the Church of Christ, and then they rebelled from that a little bit and went all the way to Baptist. And so I grew up mostly in Baptist and independent churches that had been Baptist. They just took the name off, but nothing else changed, that kind of thing, mostly in Southern California. And so really wonderful upbringing, good relationships with my parents, with the church, and so forth. And, you know, at a certain point, I remember really just falling in love with Jesus and wanting to make my discipleship a center part of my life. So that's going on. And at the same time, I was, you know, in retrospect, it's easier to see these things. I was a really nerdy kid in many respects. I mean, I always knew I was a smart kid, but I was one of those weird kids who loved to just, you know, go out in nature and find things and pickle it in jars and, you know, dissect the rattlesnake that we found at the back door and freak out the babysitter with the organs that I've stuck in the refrigerator and stuff like that.
Just as an example.
It did go that way. Yeah. So I just loved the natural world. I remember in high school zoology class just staring at my hand, tripping out on just how amazing and marvelous it was, and that God made this thing, this human hand, in all of its complexity and wonder. And so there was part of me that was drawn to that kind of vocational space, but at the same time, completely unintentionally, the churches that I grew up in, unintentionally sort of sent me this sort of gentle message that if you're really serious about your relationship with Jesus, well, then you got to do churchy stuff. You got to be a pastor. I knew I didn't want to do that. Well, then short of that, what about a missionary? Or it's like, what? But definitely there, it felt like there was a sort of hierarchy of professions that if you're really serious about Jesus, you sort of had to fall in, and being a scientist was not in that list. So when I went off to college and went to a Christian college, I was pre-missions, pre-med. Because, you know, that's one way you could do the sciencey stuff is if you're helping people, yeah. You know, so that's a good thing. Yeah. And it was when I was in college at Calvin College, now Calvin University, where I learned, well, wait a minute, the whole world is God's. All of the cultural elements, this is our Father's world. And I can be a faithful disciple and do his work in the scientific space as well. And that opened up my imagination to being to working out my faith as a scientist in that sphere and being his representative in that space, so that my mission field suddenly becomes the sciences. And I made a hard turn from biology to the psychological sciences, because it was for some of the same reasons. I was just fascinated by the complexity of human thought, how our minds work, how our brains and our biochemistry give rise to these behavioral tendencies, how thoughts and feelings are formed, how that motivates behavior and so forth. And so I went into the science end of psychology and studied cognitive psychology and developmental psychology first. But most of my work has been on the scientific study of religion, as it is known. And so that kind of has pushed me into some anthropological spaces as well. And so I'm a dabbler. I do lots of different stuff.
Dabbling's a good thing.
Yeah,
that one's a good thing.
I'm just having a great time. It's fun.
One of the things that you've talked about before, researched before, is the uniqueness of humans. That's one of the things you've dabbled in, and how,
that's right,
as opposed to other parts of creation, there's a uniqueness to humans, even in infancy. Something special or different about human beings. Can you just touch on that a little bit, what you've studied and seen?
Sure, yeah. One of the sort of happy accidents, if there are such things, you might call it providential, aspects of my education was I didn't want to study babies or children at all, but I found a doctoral advisor who was happy for me to study how people think about God. He had never done that before, as long as part of my education was a developmental approach, so looking at children, because that's one of the things he was interested in. And he rightly pointed out, sometimes we understand the mature form, adults, by looking at our development. Well, how did we get to where we are, especially with really complex things? So I ended up learning a little bit about early childhood development as well. And one of the things that you can't help but notice when you start studying, especially how children think and how their, what we call cognition, their thoughts, their problem solving, their perception, how that develops, is it develops importantly differently than what we see in other animals. And sometimes those comparisons are done by people working in the same lab, right? They'll run adult chimpanzees versus a two-year-old child in the same kinds of tasks and things like that. And you know, it's become sort of in vogue to sort of minimize the difference between humans and other animals, especially if you're working from an evolutionary perspective. There's this tendency to say, well, evolution works by incremental changes, little bitty changes that pile up over time. Now, of course, even if that's true, it doesn't follow that over lots of time. It's suggested that, yeah, from that evolutionary perspective, right, that our most recent common ancestor with a chimpanzee was like 6 million years ago. Well, that's a long time, so we can get a pretty big difference even incrementally. Nonetheless, there's this tendency to try to downplay that and say, we're just kind of, you know, less hairy and maybe in some ways less coordinated apes. But if you look carefully at what these science labs are discovering, that's just not the case. There's some really important differences. One of the biggest important differences that we see between babies and even adult chimpanzees, or pick your favorite animal that you want to compare us to, is our ability to, think of it this way, mentally enter the space with somebody else, to take the perspective of somebody else, to jointly, you and I right now are having a conversation, we're jointly attending to each other's thoughts. We're thinking about what each other are thinking. In fact, you and I can be jointly thinking about what listeners are thinking about when I say something really crazy sounding. And you might be thinking, should I edit that out?
Taking notes right now.
Yeah. Just kidding. Ooh, that one's got to go. But you and I can put an object in front of us, and just by our glances, we can go, okay, are we looking at the same thing? And that's a really important little thing that we don't see well-developed in other animals. But it is there in spades in a 9-month-old infant. Well, why is that so important? Well, it's important if you're a social animal that learns a lot from others. Because then you and I can be checking in on whether, if you're the grown-up and I'm the baby, you can be checking to make sure I'm paying attention to the same thing that you want me to pay attention to. You might be putting a verbal utterance to that, a grunt, a squeak or something that we'll call a word later as it gets developed. Yeah. And I need to know that, oh no, that thing that we're jointly attending to is the thing that you're trying to label. You might be trying to show me how to manipulate an object, how to move it around in space. You're checking to make sure I'm attending to how you're doing it, preparatory activities and so forth and so on. All of that builds up that joint attention, and especially in knowing that we're doing this together. It's not just that you and I are looking at the same thing, but we're checking in with each other to know that we're looking at the same thing, and we form some kind of a goal in that space. Well, that's the root of teaching that humans use to build up all of this cultural knowledge that we have that then sets us so far apart from other kinds of animals. So it's like there's this small but important difference in our ability to attend to others' mental states, to enter in that joint space. But that then blows up into all of this cultural learning that makes us so radically different than any other animal alive. We can be having this conversation about how do we get here? I assure you, there's no chimpanzee talking about how we're different than, you know, those humans and how we're different than gorillas and things like that. I mean, they just can't get there. And it's not because they aren't smart. They are. It's not because they don't have coordination. They do have it in spades. It's not because they're not social. They are. But they're missing some little bit that we've got by 9 months old. And it's this ability to learn from each other, among other things. And then we get this ratcheting up. So little differences can have these huge consequences. And so we're a really cool kind of species just from that perspective, that has invaded pretty much every ecological niche all over the world, at least that large animals can invade on the land. And we did it not by genetic mutations, but by cultural learning. Because genetically, we're basically all the same everywhere we go. That's pretty cool. The other animals that have sort of spread far and wide, they did it by biologically changing their genetic makeup, not us. We've managed to, you know, explore, subdue the world through this sort of social intelligence and learning from each other. And partly that builds on these early developing cognitive mechanisms that we just don't see in other animals.
That's really, really fascinating. You talked about this more in your talk at Exploring Personhood 2022. Listeners, we'll put that in the show notes if you want to go hear some more on this. Let me go back to what you mentioned a little while ago about being in the church at a young age and feeling like or being told that if you really love God, then you'll serve in this particular ministry. And if you just love him a little bit less, then you can do this. And then if you love him a little bit less, then you can work a regular job. And I don't think that's uncommon. I mean, I'm a pastor. And one of the things I'm having to continually remind my folks is it's not that pastors are up here and everybody else is down here. To quote our own Dr. Benjamin Quinn, there is a centrality of those who minister with the word, but not a superiority. That's a big difference. Thinking about that and your own experiences in that, you told me earlier that one of the things you're working on now is helping to encourage Christians who feel called to the sciences in some form.
to encourage them to do that well. And of course, we would believe that's important, right? Because as you said, God is sovereign over all things, and he's sovereign over the world, and so he wants believers in every sphere of culture and serving different things. Could you speak a little bit about what that entails, and maybe even a word to our listeners who maybe they feel called to science in some way and don't know what to do with that? Just speak to that a little bit.
Look, there are a handful of these spheres of vocational spheres, for lack of a better term, that are major culture shapers in the world today. Education is one of those. Government is another. Arts and entertainment is the third. And really, science and technology is the fourth, at least, by my lights, as far as I can tell. These are major shapers right now of global cultural conversations. And what I find it's tragic is that in one of these big four, and arguably in at least two of these big four, but we'll talk about the science and tech one, Christ followers are woefully underrepresented. Mm. We are not in the leadership positions close to proportionately to the size of us as a people in the world today. And that's a problem, because then we are always kind of outsiders looking in while other people are making the decisions and sort of dragging culture around. Well, it shouldn't be that way. If we think that Christ-centered truths are important for the world today, we have got to be in those spaces bringing that forward, in an appropriate, compassionate, loving, humble sort of way. But we need to be there, and we're not there the way that we should be. So we need more folks going into the sciences and science-related technological fields. But we need Christ followers going into that space as fully, I use the word integrated, as integrated people, that their faith informs, motivates, and affects how I go about thinking about my role as a scientist and how I do that. It's not good enough just to say, well, I'm a member of the local church. I love Jesus. I do, the churchy stuff on Sundays and maybe Wednesday nights, but the rest of the time I just do science just like everybody else, and I'm motivated just like everybody else. No, that's not how it should work. Now, I'm not proposing we go in and do an entirely different kind of science, because it turns out the sciences were built on, yes, some sort of Greek rationalist assumptions, but also some very Christian kinds of foundations, mm-hmm. or you might even say Judeo-Christian ones. And it's those kinds of foundational commitments that I think it's important for us Christ followers to be mindful of. And once we are, we realize, oh yeah, doing science stuff is a natural extension of our faith. It's not a weird sort of sewn-on appendage. It's the real deal. One of my favorite biblical passages that I like to throw out in this regard is, we're in 1 Kings, and Solomon has been, he's going to be the next king, and God says, okay, I'm my paraphrase. God's like, so I'm going to hook you up with some real special gifts. What do you need? And Solomon wisely says, I need wisdom, right? We all know that part of the story. And then we jump from there to, and wisdom means knowing when and how to cut babies in half, right? And we get to the baby cutting story, and that's what we all remember. And what we forget is there's this wonderful passage where it says, and Solomon, in all of his wisdom, right, learned all about the plants, the animals, natural stuff, that people all over that ancient world would come to hear him talk on those things. He basically, had the folk science of the day on lockdown. He was really good at that. That was part of the wisdom that God gave him in order to shepherd God's chosen people, right? It's important, and it's God-given stuff. This is God's wisdom for creation, after all. One way to summarize how I try to encourage people who are thinking about how their faith and their work as a science professional might go together is sort of five big questions that I think we all need to answer for ourselves. The first is, does my faith provide an adequate kind of foundation for doing the work of a scientist? I think the answer is yes, but I think it's something you have to sort of wrestle with a little bit yourself. You could break that one into, does it motivate the doing of science, and does it provide an adequate philosophical foundation? I think in both of those can be easily answered yes for me, but that's because I've struggled with it. But I think those are worth thinking about. So that's question one. Does it provide an adequate kind of foundation? Second, how does my faith then motivate my particular topics of study? One of the things, you're right, it's not obvious what you're going to study as a scientist. You have to make decisions. Well, where does that decision-making come from? Well, it comes from your values, your commitments, your priorities. What matters to you? Is it worth doing? Well, our faith should surely inform that, right? So second is then, how does my faith inform or motivate my particular topics of study? Third, how does my faith inform, shape, or influence my methodology? And again, you might at first blush think, well, you just do the usual science thing. No, no, no. There are all kinds of decisions that have to be made as a scientist in terms of exactly how you're going to do your research protocol. What kind of rigor are you going to bring to the task? How are you going to treat, I work in human sciences. How are you going to treat human subjects? How are you going to treat animal subjects? And it's not just, these aren't just sort of bland ethical questions that everybody is going to answer the same way. These are calculations in terms of, well, how much risk or how much discomfort versus how much expected payoff am I going to put people through? am I making sure that the research that I'm going to, that I'm doing is going to benefit the population of people I'm drawing subjects from? And there are lots of different questions in this space. So that one's worth wrestling with too. That's the third question, is how does my faith inform my research methodology? In part, that includes my statistics, how I mathematically interpret my findings, my analyses. Am I doing the best analyses? Am I hiding things with my statistics? Am I boldly seeking the truth there? Which then leads to the fourth question, which is, how does my faith impact how I interpret and present my findings? How do I share these with the world? Where do I emphasize things? What applications do I think are merited and worth exploring? Am I really passionate seeking the truth through my studies, or am I propping up an ideology? Right, it's easy even to slip into that ideological kind of thinking instead of saying, no, I, as a Christ follower, I should be truth aimed here. And that's how I'm going to make a good contribution and hopefully earn the respect of others, even people who are not people of faith. So that's the fourth question. And the fifth question is, how is my faith informing how I interact with my colleagues? We often think about science as sort of that lonely, you know, genius in the corner with their test tubes and or their apparatus and all that other stuff. But the truth of the matter is scientists are deeply collaborative. They work in lab groups most of the time, and we build off of other lab groups' findings. And so we're constantly presenting our findings to each other and critiquing and refereeing articles and so forth. Well, how am I treating my colleagues then in this space? Am I remembering their humanity, that they're fellow image bearers, that I need to, the best I can, love them, even when they're trying to take me down? Am I just treating them as brains on a stick or as full people? And that's challenging sometimes. But that's, I think, a fifth face of the scientific profession that's worth Christ followers wrestling with. And so the book that I'm working on that hopefully will help, my brothers and sisters think through how to do that integrative work for themselves is based on those five questions. And then I unpack those as lots of other sub-questions. But the aim being, we need more Christ followers going into these sciencey spaces, but as fully integrated, thoughtful, reflective scientists, and letting their faith do work in these spaces, not as, well, I'm just going to pretend to be just like everybody else. I don't think that does anybody of any faith or worldview any favors, because what it ends up doing is we might say, well, then you go least common denominator. No, we don't. What we do is we passively accept whatever we think is the accepted worldview that's going to be foundational for doing the sciences. And as the last, I think, 4 years have especially shown us, there are all kinds of competing agendas behind so-called scientific work. People are bringing in their value systems there. Well, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We need to bring our values in there too and be honest about where it makes a difference and where maybe it just doesn't in the ways that you might think. And that's okay as long as we're again, I think being faithful to our theological commitments, our discipleship, and just doing the best science we can because we're truth aimed about it.
That's a good word for all of us in any vocation, to let our faith affect how we do our work, whether we're scientists or janitors or anything in between. That we let
and hopefully
faith,
pastors
and
too.
Hopefully pastors, Lord willing, yeah, absolutely. That we let our faith infuse how we do that. Before we let you go, let me ask you a question we ask all of our guests in the Christ and Culture podcast. It's a segment called "On My Bookshelf." We like to ask our guests what they're reading right now. So, Dr. Barrett, what's a book that you are reading now or that you just enjoy in general?
One that I am currently reading is by Daniel J. Levitin. It is a book called Aging Successfully. And he is a neuroscientist and cognitive scientist. And it's really talking about the aging brain and what can we do to make sure that we age better. I've studied a little bit on the baby side of things. Reading about getting old is not something I've done as much on, so it's fun to learn new stuff as far as that goes. And as sort of a fun personal note, my wife and I do a lot of line dancing. She's a line dance instructor.
I would expect no less.
Yep. We do a little bit of, actually, we've started dabbling in choreography, but one of the things we're really drawn to is line dancing is awfully good for your brain and your body, as well as, having all these social benefits. So we're becoming kind of boosters of that. And the things I'm reading in this book are like, oh yeah, no, we've stumbled on the right thing. This is going to keep us younger, longer, and it's a good thing to sort of be promoting.
So starting next week in the Christ and Culture podcast, not just on my bookshelf, but on the dance floor.
On the dance floor.
Where our guests share their favorite dance moves and whatnot. Okay. Dr. Barrett, it's been a joy having you back on again. How can people follow you and follow your work?
Well, you can check us out at Blueprint's website, www.blueprint1543. That's blueprint1543.org. Or we've recently launched our own little video series. I think we're just calling it Dr. Justin Barrett. It's on YouTube, new experiment that we're trying, little short things where, please write in, ask me questions of topics you'd like me to just sort of give a 10-minute sort of riff on that hopefully is science-informed and faithful to God's Word so that's another thing you can look up on YouTube.
Well, cool. All listeners, we'll have to check that out and ask some hard questions to Dr. Barrett, and maybe he'll tell you a little bit about line dancing.
Absolutely.
Dr. Barrett, thanks for being on again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Christ and Culture. If you will, give us a 5-star rating and a review on your podcast platform, and we'll see you next time.